Hi, this is Matt. Hi, this is Matthew Kale with MGBN, Millennium Grown Broadcast Network, and this is 1620 Talk, Cannabis Communication for Veterans. Today we're continuing our mini-series on veterans organizations, both old and new. Today we are going to be profiling one particular organization, IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War. Now, Iraq Veterans Against the War was originally founded by Iraq War veterans in July of around 2004 at the annual convention of Veterans for Peace in Boston, who they gave a large voice to a very large number of active duty service people and veterans who are against this particular war, but are obviously under various pressures to remain silent. And from its inception, IVAW has called for three things mainly: immediate withdrawal of all occupying forces in Iraq, reparations for the human and structural damages Iraq has suffered, and stopping the corporate pillaging of Iraq so that the people can control their own lives and future. And, of course, third, full benefits, adequate health care, including mental health, and other supports for returning servicemen and women. Of course, this third issue is primary in those three issues. Obviously, Iraq Veterans Against the War, there are a lot of people, you know, in the veteran community that may have a negative opinion about Iraq Veterans Against the War. There are a lot of people who classify them as peaceniks and, hippies and that kind of thing, in which they kind of denigrate Iraq Veterans Against the War for being against war in general. And there is a fringe element within Iraq Veterans Against the War, which actually they do believe in the demilitarization of the United States, but I do not believe that they actually speak for the vast majority of service members that are actually within the ranks of Iraq Veterans Against the War. The vast majority of people that are in this movement seem to be only against the Iraq War in particular. The people that I've talked to, primarily, they actually, they do not think that our entry into Iraq was lawful or justified, because Iraq had not actually launched any specific attacks against the American nation. And that's a really important point to realize, because in truth, the only real justification for war is ever a direct attack from a foreign country against our own. That's really the only justified response, you know, is war in that case. If somebody unprovokedly actually attacks America, such as what happened at 9/11, then obviously America has got to respond. But 9/11, as we all know, had nothing to do with Iraq, even though in the years following 9/11, the administration did everything in their power to attempt to link 9/11 to Iraq and try to basically imply that Iraq had some sort of functional role in the attack of 9/11, when history has told us pretty much unequivocally that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and his group, that they were almost solely responsible for the destruction of the World Trade Center on 9/11 of 2001, which is a hell of a story, I got to tell you. At the time, I myself was living in New York City, and I was living in the financial district, not more than a block and a half from the World Trade Center, just across Broadway from the World Trade Center. It was my apartment was on a tiny little street called Maiden Lane in the financial district. We were right down the street from the Bank of America headquarters, which is where my brother worked at the time. And I had a lot of friends in the financial industry, and there were a remarkable number of people that we lost that day. was a very, very, very personal blow for a lot of Americans, and it was something that a lot of us simply just could not tolerate. There had to be some kind of response. So that's exactly what we did. We did respond. We responded to Afghanistan, which is where Osama bin Laden and his network, Al-Qaeda, were located, and they were being protected by the Taliban. So we had to move into there. We had to respond to the threat to American lives and American safety. And we went into Afghanistan. So, unfortunately, in the years after that, it only took 2 or 3 years, but eventually George Bush and the neocon establishment, they started to direct our attention towards Iraq and North Korea, the so-called Axis of Evil, and Iran. And these nations became a target, despite the fact that they haven't ever actually done anything particularly against the U.S. There's been a lot of talk, a lot of threats, a lot of bombastic sort of narrative, but really there's been no action. It's all talk, and honestly, that's no reason to go to war. There's no reason to go to war over somebody talking a bunch of big game but never actually doing anything about it. So, in my opinion, a lot of the fundamental principles of the Iraq Veterans Against the War movement, they're fundamentally sound in my mind. They actually have a lot of intelligent narrative on the Iraq war in particular. Now, the fringe element that is involved in ideas about the complete demilitarization of America, open borders, and things like that, that's a fringe element, honestly, in my opinion, and it's not something that the vast majority of IVAW members that they particularly ascribe to. They don't actually believe that that's the direction that Americans should go. These guys are veterans. They're just like you and me. They believe in America, and they believe in what we have here, specifically the principle of freedom, because that's what distinguishes America from the rest of the world. It's the principle of freedom. That's what we were founded upon, the individual freedoms and the individual rights, the natural rights of a human being. Natural rights meaning derived from the very virtue of our birth. All of these things are simply an issue of freedom, and that applies when we're talking about cannabis too, because cannabis, it's a plant. It grows everywhere, literally on every continent in the world except for Antarctica, and it grows with very little help. It doesn't require any care or anything like that. It grows wild. Feral hemp is literally seen all across the United States, and it's here only because we brought it here, and feral hemp seed has escaped from tractors and trailers and trains all across the U.S. and has managed to gain a foothold in the hinterlands. This plant literally is everywhere in the world. It comes straight from the earth. God gives it to us, no one else. And for man to think that he could take away a God-given right such as this is nothing short of an atrocity in my mind. The fact that they feel the need to legislate and to take away the rights of individual Americans simply for using a plant, it just seems backwards. It seems contrary to everything we stand for as an American nation. We are about freedom and about personal freedom and about the lack of interference from government. That's what we were founded upon. People originally in America, they revolted because government had too much of a hand in their lives. Government has again taken a huge hand in our lives. Unfortunately, we have a very how shall I say this? An acrimonious sort of relationship between our political parties right now. They're at each other's throats. There's nothing they can do. They simply fight all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And the American people are simply fed up with it. We want someone to get into power that can actually do something, that actually backs up what he says, not some vague promises of change and hope, but real, actual progress, measurable, distinct, real, something we can see, something we can touch, something we can feel. And in Colorado, we've actually managed to get it. We can walk into a dispensary in almost any city in the state, and we can touch the marijuana. We can feel the marijuana. We can smell the marijuana. That's freedom, folks. That's the smell of freedom. And here in Colorado, we've managed to reclaim a very small part of it, a very small part. But in truth, there's so much more ground that we need to cover. There are sacred plants aplenty in this world, and it doesn't matter what tradition they come from. Many of them have similar actions. We could be talking about West African tribes using the iboga plant, or we could be talking about South American tribes using ayahuasca, or Central American peoples using psilocybin mushrooms. All of these things have been shown unequivocally to be very effective in the treatment of PTSD, anxiety disorders, and any kind of end-of-life issues that may come about as a result of being unsure of what's going to happen. So many people that are facing cancer, they're facing terminal illness of various different kinds. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's HIV, AIDS, or cancer, or even degenerative elderly diseases like diabetes, because eventually that's terminal too. PTSD itself is a terminal condition that oftentimes ends in suicide. 22 a day in the veteran population, and over 112 people a day kill themselves in the general population. Suicide. They kill themselves. They're no longer here. No one will ever see them again. Their presence is gone, and we are forever poorer as a result. These people are killing themselves in record numbers, and we are doing nothing about it. Politicians in power are simply turning a cold shoulder to this crisis, and it is a crisis. It is not an understatement to say that this is a crisis when 112 people a day in the general population and over 22 in the veteran population are killing themselves. Whether it's shooting themselves in the face or hanging themselves in the closet or overdosing on prescription pills, folks, this is happening every day. And believe it or not, it is happening in your community. It could be happening in the house right next door to you. Veterans are everywhere in this population. Last I checked, we're something like 7.6%. That's almost 1 out of 10. You can believe, bank on it, count on it, that the vast majority of people that you see in the day, they have traumatic experiences in their lives. Everyone does. And for short periods of time, we all suffer from post-traumatic stress. It's not unusual. It's a very common occurrence in life. This is one thing that we can honestly say, that this is a fact of life. This is something that is integral to what happens in life. We are all exposed to trauma, and for short periods of time in our lives, sometimes we just can't handle it. We shut down. We start isolating ourselves. We start shutting out the people in life that can help us. And we start down that long spiral into darkness. It's a horrible thing to experience. And honestly, I don't know if it's more horrible to experience or if it's more horrible to watch. To watch someone you love spiral downward to the point where they are ready to give up on everything. They're ready to kill themselves. They're ready to take their own lives simply because they can't handle it anymore. They can't handle the fact that things were done to them or that they have done things in their lives which are simply unforgivable. Somehow, we all as veterans have to find some way to forgive ourselves. Matt, are you on the line yet? No. So we don't have Matt Stice yet. Matt Stice of Iraq Veterans Against the War. So anyway, I've been rambling now for a bit about our issue here, the veteran issue with PTSD and with individuals killing themselves on a daily basis, whether it's 22 or more in the veteran population or 112 a day in the general population, that's an atrocious number. It's out of control. In any other discipline, this would be termed as not just an epidemic, but a pandemic. This is obviously taking more lives than any other issue in America today. Do we have somebody on the line? Anybody there?
I'm on the line. Can you hear me?
Matt, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, good news. We finally have Matt Stice on the line of IVAW. So, anyway, I've been rambling now for a while about a PTSD issue in America. And before I launch into that, really, I'd like to get a personal snapshot of your story. And how and when did you begin to serve in the U.S. Armed Forces? Where did you serve? And what branch of service were you in?
Yeah, Matt, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, yeah, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I've been listening to what you have to say and give you a little piece of my military experience, which first started when I, after I graduated high school way back in 1990, and joined the Army originally September 11th. Or actually, my first day in the Army was September 11th, 1990, of all dates. And joined the infantry, and I was stationed down at Fort Benning, where I went to basic training and completed infantry school. Then I found myself here in Colorado. It was actually January of 1991, where I stationed at Fort Carson for the first time. And you know, that was a time where the Gulf War had begun, and being very young, not really recognizing what I was really doing in the military, but just going along with the flow, because at that age, you just kind of look to the person in front of you and just follow the orders and try to keep your head straight. So that's what I tried to do and try to be a model soldier at that time. Did everything that was asked of me. We were initially called as an infantry unit to go to Kuwait, but that was short-lived, and we were called back very quick without even leaving Fort Carson. So we never actually went to war. We were preparing to go, but since it was such a short conflict, we never went. So I ended up finishing out 2 years of active duty service, which finished in 1992. January, that was the end of 92. January of 93, I joined the Pennsylvania National Guard to finish out my 6 years left on my contract, which I finished in the Pennsylvania National Guard as both a combat medic and also a anti-tank gunner. The MOS was designated 11 Hotel for a mechanized unit. So that was my first term of service, where I served from 1990 to August of 98, which completed my 8 years of service. Never thought after that I'd ever experience my service in the military. As things are, things, are quite chaotic in life, and that was the case for me. And in 2005, I ended up joining the United States Army once again, and found myself in Warrior Transition Course in August of 2005, just about the time that Katrina had hit the southern part of the United States.
So wait, you got out, and then you actually, once the war popped off, you actually voluntarily got back in.
I did. I don't know, a seed must have been planted in me in the early 90s that, for this thirst to go to war. I don't know. The definition of veteran to me seemed to always represent some sort of service in a war zone, even though I was a veteran, a legitimate veteran, through my service up until 98. For some reason, 2005, well, there's many different reasons, and it's a long story, and you don't have enough time right now to go through those different nuances. But, yeah, as it was, I think one of the things that really propelled me back into service was, well, the attack on our country, and then also the fact that I never served in a war zone, and I felt that that was necessary.
There does seem to be some kind of draw. I know that when I signed up, I had a pick of any job that I wanted in the armed forces, really. But I chose the infantry because I figured that the only reason to really volunteer in the military was to fight a war. If we were being attacked and we were going to fight a war, then absolutely, yeah, let's go ahead and serve. But, personally, I was brought up as a military brat, and I kind of had a negative view of the military before I joined because of my father. I saw how strict he was, and pretty much, pardon my language, but how much of a hard ass he was. And I didn't want to be that person. So I avoided the military for a long time up until the point that our country got attacked. And at that point, I made the decision. I was like, I want to fight. And if I'm going to join the military, I'm going to join an MOS where I can actually fight. Is that like a pretty common thing,
Well, the thing is, I think it was actually different. I was in infantry, and getting back in, I recognized that a veteran that only served in the infantry didn't have many skills outside in the civilian world.
Yeah.
So my time after my service actually was spent trying to figure out, how do I apply this infantry training to, everyday life, which was almost impossible unless I was deciding to become a police officer or security.
Yeah.
So I actually changed my understanding of things and went back in 2005 as a power generation technician, thinking that as a generator mechanic that I'd have more options once I did get out of the military once again and have that training, a solid training behind me where I could actually apply it to a job, in the civilian sector, which never really transpired. But that was my thinking at the time that, actually I wanted to be something different than combat arms. I wanted to be a part of the war effort, but in a different aspect where I was looking toward my future as well, as far as what I could do after my military experience the second time around. And that was to use that as a kind of a push to a new career. And like I said, never materialized that way, but, the Army uses you in the ways they want to use you, and I was certainly used differently in Iraq than my title would indicate,
Yeah, there's a lot of mission creep that with, you may get assigned a particular MOS, but you end up finding yourself doing a lot of the other jobs, the other MOSs, especially when you're in a war zone. I mean, it's pretty much necessity, right,
Yeah, it's whatever the Army needs you to do. As a part of a maintenance unit, I think 10% of our maintenance unit actually was turning wrenches and doing the actual maintenance, whereas the rest of the unit was you know, running security clearance, doing protecting yeah. entry control points like I was, doing missions that were considered secret that I don't even know about to this day. So, I mean, yeah, it just is, you know, it depends on what the mission is and what the Army feels that's most important at the time. They always indicate that you're always 11 Bravo first, no matter what your MOS is. And so yeah. I guess as luck would have it, I still had that infantry training behind me. Even though, as it was, I think some people had some things wrong on the military regs where I was denied the ability to wear my infantry cord while I was serving in a maintenance unit, which I still think that that was wrong. But
yeah, anyway. I don't think that they're actually authorized to do that. If you have earned
honor,
think so. Yeah, I think you are allowed to wear that honor on your Class A's or on your, you know, dress uniform, no matter what the honor is. It doesn't matter. If you have earned a CIB, if you have earned a blue cord, you are allowed to wear that no matter what your MOS is at the current time.
I think it was a matter of people being embarrassed that, you know, some people had more on their uniform than others had with a lot more time in service. But that's just another story.
Yeah, well.
So,
like, let me cut to the chase here. Like, you know, this is a cannabis show. It's about cannabis and veterans. So you are a cannabis patient now, right?
I am. Well, it's not something that's recognized by the VA, but it is something that I will say to anybody that asks me that, you know, I prefer cannabis. Prefer meaning that's the only preference I have. I don't take any pills. I don't even drink alcohol. I quit drinking alcohol almost 6 years ago. And so, yeah, cannabis is the only thing that I use. I'm not saying that it's the end-all, be-all to everybody's problems or pains, but it certainly has helped me be a better person and be able to survive in this world where I've seen too many of my friends not be able to come grips with their time in service and the things that that they've been morally damaged by, to the point where, you know, some of my friends aren't even around to this day because of that. And some of them even, you know, may have used cannabis, may have not, but when it comes down to it, I feel like cannabis is the major piece in my life that has kept me alive. Along with that is having friends in the veterans community that I can talk with, and especially veterans that use cannabis, because, you know, we're a group of people that understand each other, even if we have differing opinions on our service or experiences in life or how we live life. We still know that there is a plant that is available, or at least available in Colorado more so than the rest of the nation, that can help us, and it is something that's tangible that we can hold on to. We can grow it. It's not something that we look at and say, what is this? It's a, you know, press into a pill form. I don't recognize those things, because it could be
yeah.
anything to me. Whereas a plant, I can at least say this, you know, I know that this came out of the ground. And so, yeah, that's how I look
yeah,
at it.
Yeah, you can pluck the flowers, you can squeeze it, you can smell it. You say, that is cannabis, you know.
Right.
Whereas with all these other pills, who knows what you're taking? You may be taking, it's just the color and shape the pill. You have to take their word for it, essentially what they're giving you. But I do think that there is, like, a certain amount of there's a tendency in the cannabis community to try to make cannabis out to be some kind of magic bullet that cures everything. And I think that's one of the myths that we need to dispel, that it is, like, it truly is a very effective treatment, but it is not a magic bullet. It's not the be-all, end-all. It's not going to fix everything. It's not going to cure everything. And it may not help everyone. There are some people that it's just not going to work well with their systems. So, you know, you got to try it out, and you got to keep an open mind. But, you know, obviously don't put all your eggs in one basket and expect cannabis to completely fix all of your problems. I think that's one of the shortcomings of our current movement, is that we tend to push cannabis as a cure-all, and it's just not. It's one more tool in the toolbox.
Well, right? I also think that You know, I also think that we're handcuffed a bit. You know, we could sit here and I can truly say that, yeah, it's not the end all be all, and it's not, but it's something that hasn't, you know, we haven't had the opportunity to research it fully. We know that, you know, and you know that this is a plant that can really bring a lot more to the table than even people like ourselves even recognize at this point, because we haven't had the ability to research like other drugs have been researched. You know, they have the ability because of the money and the scheduling of certain things to be able to research and gain knowledge on, you know, from this research. But we haven't had the, you know, the true opportunity to research cannabis like we should be able to. And that's one of the problems. So, and also the nuances of the multiples of strains out there that could affect me differently than it affects you. So, like, we haven't even, like, touched, you know, like, the understanding of cannabis. And I'll agree with you that, you know, it's not the end-all be-all, but it's certainly an option that should at least be provided for not only veterans but anybody. And it's an, and
well,
it's an option.
Yeah, it's safety profile. It just, I mean, its safety profile alone lends itself to the use for almost anybody. If you want to try it for a condition, it should be allowed, right? I mean, it's like less toxic than aspirin, right?
Exactly.
So anyway, so what exactly, what conditions, if you don't mind me asking, what conditions do you use cannabis to treat?
Well, it's interesting, you know, as it stands right now, the VA recognizes me as being 60% disabled. So as they break it down, that means 30% PTSD, 10% for my right shoulder, 10% for my right knee, and 10% for my right ankle. All problems on my right side, which seems like I'm a little bit off balance, but it's actually doesn't include other issues that I have. But as it is, you know, just talking about those specifics, you know, I dislocated my ankle when I was in the Army, and I have a piece of government metal in my ankle, as it, you know, for the rest of my life, and I deal with pain from that. My service in the military, especially in a war zone, we wore a lot of weight, and that wore down my back, and I deal with mid and lower back pain because of it. That's something that wasn't recognized by the VA, along with my neck pain. They did, so it's really kind of funny, you know, I point those two things out or indicate those things because I don't, you know, it's almost, it's like the VA was like, and I feel privileged that the VA actually recognized my situation, and I do have percentage, whereas many veterans do not. But it's just the way they look at things is kind of confusing to me, where, you know, the importance of the pain that I'm dealing with in my ankle doesn't seem to be as important with the pain that I'm managing in my neck or my back, which I feel are certainly more debilitating in a lot of ways. You know, I could probably be off my feet more so, but I have to, you know, as a student at UCCS, I'm a senior, and I need to be at a computer a lot, and I have a lot of back and neck issues that affect me when I'm on a computer, so I can't spend, you know, I have to get up most of the time and walk around and walk off this pain. So these are and, you know, these are things that I'm managing, but, you know, so that's what I personally use cannabis for. And also it extends, you know, when I talk about PTSD, this is something that extends into something that is not talked about a lot, that parallels PTSD, which is moral injury. You know, a lot of us, you know, went in to serve in the military and serve specifically in a war zone to protect our nation or to, get some sort of, it was like our way of retaliating for being attacked. And then we found out that our service, just specifically in Iraq, where I was something different than what we were told. So, I, along with many other veterans, you know, deal with this moral injury or this confusion about our service and, you know, why we were led to believe certain things. And so that's a piece of that.
Yeah, PTSD, this is a major, major central issue, I think, in the issue of PTSD in general, is the fact that this is, It's obviously it's not a physical injury. It's a mental injury. It's a spiritual injury, and it's an emotional injury. And these are things that cannot be treated through traditional means. And I mean, cannabis does help. It got me to a place where I could actually start to think about reaching out into the world and reengaging, breaking my isolation. But it was the community of veterans that I got into contact with after I started using cannabis that actually, I think that it probably healed me a lot more than the cannabis actually did by itself. Cannabis was a very, very important part, and I don't think the other thing would have happened without the cannabis. But once I started to get integrated into a community of veterans that were like-minded and that we all had similar issues, we had similar problems, and we're all just trying to get through it together, that was more healing in itself. The community, the breaking of that isolation was far more beneficial to my mental health than even the cannabis was by itself. I mean, it's probably a pretty close tie, but they're both extremely, extremely important in the rehabilitation of people with PTSD.
Well, I would agree with that. I would say that bond that we all, or majority of us veterans, have with other veterans or service members when we're still in is pretty strong. And when we exit the military, we kind of lose those connections, and you can really never get that back. But, you know, these groups that you're talking about, these veteran-led groups or groups built of veterans, and specifically around cannabis, really brings back to the fold that, like, that feeling of camaraderie and the ability to be around people that with shared experiences that you can relate to, and you can actually have some real talk and feel comfortable around. And I think that comfort and that safety is a key to that, to be able to, like, be real and do it, like, in an environment where you're able to medicate and others are medicating around you, and it's more fulfilling than just going to a bar, at least for me. You know, I remember going to a bar and drinking beers, and there's a difference there, like the way the alcohol affects one's perceptions as opposed to the way cannabis affects people's perceptions. And I think cannabis leads to more dialogue, whereas, you know, alcohol leads to, I don't know, in my estimation, more aggressive nature. So,
well, yeah, it tends to suppress whatever you're thinking about, whereas cannabis kind of, it allows you to delve down deep into it and talk about it without having that emotional reaction about it. You can sit there and you can shoot the shit with your friends and with your veteran buddies, and you don't have to engage in the emotional turmoil that you went through during that actual event. You can talk about it in a more impersonal manner and really examine how it occurred and how it impacted your life in almost a third-person perspective, in which you can look at it as if you were another person, and instead of judging yourself for what you have done or what things have happened in your past, you tend to look at it more as an objective observer and say, listen, this is just something that happened to you, and it's time to move past it.
Yeah, and it's good to get into those spaces where we can have these talks, because then, you know, these conversations, you know, first are led by veterans, and then I think it, you know, kind of leaches into the community, which it needs to, because I have yet to really hear many civilians, you know, share the responsibility of going to war in Iraq. You know, I know there was millions of people that were against the war in Iraq, but there should be millions of civilians, like, looking back on that time with more, with a stricter lens, I guess, and to say, you know, why did we go there? We can't repeat this ever again, and we need to find out more information, because every day we find out seems more information about, you know, what led us to war and the reasons behind it. And I'll stop there, but basically just say that.
I gotta delve into this a little bit because we're getting around to talking about IVAW, and you know there are a lot of people that you know have this negative opinion about IVAW, you know, being peaceniks and disarming America and everything like that. But that's not really what it's about, is it? It's really about strictly the fact that Iraq itself, just Iraq, was a war of aggression, and there's really nothing else we can say about it. But it was a war of aggression, and because it was a war of aggression, it was kind of unjustified, right?
I would say it's certainly unjustified, and I would agree with you that the basis of forming Iraq Veterans Against the War was specifically to indicate that there's a group of veterans that served in Iraq that were challenged the idea that this war was a war that we should have been involved in, was a war that we should have started, and a war that was that should have been a part of our history. It's basically saying that we're against wars of aggression, and it was specific to the war in Iraq. So, yeah, you have a lot of opinions from members within Iraq Veterans Against the War that's going to, you know, say numerous things about their understandings of war and, like, war in certain areas. But, you know, when IVAW was first developed, it was under this understanding that we're against the Iraq war because this is an illegal war. And even for those veterans that didn't even serve in Iraq, these are veterans, you know, the organization was based on veterans that served after 9/11. So even if you served in Afghanistan or any other, or even served a day in basic training, you know, this was a veterans-led organization that said, we are veterans, we're against this war of aggression, you know, this specific war of aggression. And I would say that IVAW's understanding of things has developed since then, since 2004. But when it comes down to it, the reason why it says against the war and Iraq veterans against the war is because we're not against all wars. We understand that there are necessary wars out there. I mean, when we look at, you know, just as an example, we were talking about this earlier. I was talking with one of the board members from IVAW, and there's examples, and I can go into it, but there's examples of wars that, and even Afghanistan could be looked at as a war that was one that was perpetuated not by, you know, the United States going into a country illegally, but perpetuated because we were attacked. And that's, you know, certainly the difference there.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that's one of the reasons when I signed up, honestly, I hoped and prayed that I didn't go to Iraq because it was something that I didn't believe in. But, you know, I was lucky enough to get sent most of my time to Afghanistan, to deployments. And I felt that I was more justified over there. However, at least towards the end, I certainly started to question why we were still there. I felt like if we had taken, I mean, at the height of troop levels in Iraq, I mean, what was it, like 170,000? What was it? Do you have any idea?
That was about the time I was there. I was there during the surge, and yeah, it was good, 150,000 plus, from what I understand. And I mean, different from all the other services, you know, the United States Army decided to keep soldiers there a lot longer on deployments than the Marines, the Navy, or the Air Force. So yeah, we were spending these longer deployments there. And I was certainly one of them that was there for that extended period of time with the surge of this influx of troops into that region, which was, from all of our understandings, was going to lead us to the end of the war because that surge was going to be the key to our military victory, which we found wasn't the case. But
well, it certainly seemed like that the surge worked for a little while, but then it I guess it started to fail after that, and I'm really not sure about that. And the narrative is probably going to be different depending on who you're talking to. A lot of right wing people will say like, "Oh no, we were strong all the way through the end, and now it's all going to hell as a result of the fact that we're leaving." But there are of course a number of different opinions on exactly how the Iraq War went down. But just getting back to your activism here. So when you got back from Iraq, how did you start to get involved in activism and in IVAW in particular?
Yeah, so I was stopped last until May of 2009. I and a bunch of other friends of mine, we got out on the same day, which was kind of cool. And so here I'm middle of 2009, and I get to enjoy a little bit of a break. I'm on not disability, but I was getting unemployment benefits. So I had a little bit of time after my transition out of the military to kind of figure some things out. And I was a bit frustrated because toward the end of my service, I got to learn a lot more about, what it meant to serve in Iraq and what the war was all about. And I was spending more time on the internet, and I was being isolating myself, I'd say, through the end of 2009 into 2010. And it wasn't until 2011 where I really started, taking my activism off, outside of my bedroom where I spent most of my time on the computer, bitching and moaning about things, where it was actually the Occupy movement locally in Colorado Springs that got me first radicalized to,
really?
Being a part of a change in what was going on. And I found that there was a lot of passion on the corner of Tejon and Bijou. And I actually, to this day, have a lot of friends that I met, through the Occupy movement here locally in Colorado Springs and also in Denver. And through that, I met members of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Or at least I was plugged into, this understanding that there's an anti-war movement going on and maybe I should be involved in, and found out that there was a meetup at Colorado College. I met up with some members, Aaron Hughes and a couple other members, and that led me to this bigger community of activists. For not only in being a veteran, I felt like I needed to use my voice because people were telling me, you need to use your voice and stand up for some of these things. And since I was passionate about it but didn't know how to articulate a lot of these things, it took me getting involved with Iraq Veterans Against the War to really learn the nuances of activism and how we challenge a lot of these themes that we look at today, and a lot of these themes that kind of stop our society from being inclusive and really allowing everybody to live life, freely in a democracy. And that's why I joined the military, so everybody has the right to, the right to a vote, the right to, all the rights that were given to us in the Bill of Rights and, what the Constitution's all about. This is why I joined. So joining IBAW was literally a way for... Joining IBAW was a way for me to build on this articulation of how to present the narrative different from what the status quo was, or the narrative from the status quo.
And this is something that I really sympathize with, because when I signed up for the military, honestly, when America was attacked, when 9/11 happened, what I saw as happening, I didn't see necessarily the Twin Towers go down. What I was looking at was freedom under attack. I was looking at our Constitution under attack. And that's what got me more angry than almost anything else. And that's what caused me to volunteer. And that's what I'm finding from the vast majority of vets that go over there and serve. We sign up for very idealistic reasons. We go up there, we hold our hand up, and we're like, yes, we will protect, serve, and defend the Constitution from enemies foreign and domestic. when we go overseas and we are fighting to defend our Constitution from these other foreign forces, but then we come back to the States and we find out, holy crap, our country is not what we thought it was, and it turns out that there are a lot of domestic enemies to the Constitution also. So a lot more veterans are coming back from overseas, and they're beginning to find their voice, or beginning to see that their country is not what they thought it was, and because we have invested so much, you know, we've given our blood, sweat, and tears to this country, that we have absolutely got to figure out some way to make this country work again. And we feel this responsibility to our country now that we have served, now that we've raised our hand, and we've done that, we've made that vow, we've made that oath that we have to come back, and we have to somehow make this thing work. We have to figure out how to fix it. That's one of the most prevalent sentiments that I find in veterans that are coming back from conflict today. Do you see that a lot?
Yeah, I think when we raise our hand to defend our nation, you know, from both foreign and domestic enemies, we never put our hand down as veterans. We continue to want to serve, and I know myself and many of the friends I have in the activist community believe the same thing, that we want to define our service by our terms, and we want to continue to serve our country in ways that it's going to progress our country and not only disable our own country, but disable other countries. It's just continuous service, continued understanding that, you know, we want to serve on our own. We want to define our service. And I think we continue to serve our country by speaking out to, you know, the things that we did and saw, speaking to the, you know, the realization, you know, the fact that we were in other countries, we served in foreign lands. You know, we might have been just stationed in Germany or Korea. So we have this understanding of a larger world where many Americans might not even have left their own communities. So we do have a different experience, more so than many Americans. So we need to use that voice to say, this is what it's all about. It's not exactly what you might hear specifically from the corporate media and other media outlets, but you need to hear it from people that actually have the experience of, you know, being there. And you need to hear it from not only the white male point of view, but you need to hear it from all voices.
Diversity is key.
Diversity is, you know, incredibly key, because if being from a male, you know, white male point of view, that intrigues only, you know, a certain portion of our population, but we need to intrigue the entire population. And that's my goal. Anyways, you know, I'm no better than, you know, an elderly woman that's, you know, waiting, you know, for the bus, or a person of color that's, you know, getting ready for school, or, you know, whatever the case, you know, I'm no better than any other person. And in this democracy, we're told that, you know, everybody has a vote, you know, once you're 18.
And everybody is supposed to be equal under the law, but in reality, it doesn't seem like it translates that way.
It's interesting. It doesn't translate that way. And I think it's frustrating for specifically us veterans when we leave the country and come back and see, wow, our country is not as great as, you know, people might perceive it. Not that we don't want it to be great, and we know that it can be great. So that's why we continue to do, you know, to be in this fight. Otherwise, why do we stick around? You know, we could be another number, like you talk about the 22 a day. We could be part of that number, or we could build that number, but we see the potential within our country, within the world population, to really lift up each other if only given the chance, and change the paradigm as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the entire the way that the country thinks about cannabis has to be changed, especially when we're talking about the wounds of war, but in a lot of civilian issues too. But does IVAW, do they have like an official like policy or like statement having to do with cannabis or anything like that, or are they just kind of floating around on the outskirts? But I have seen a number of IVAW members be very pro-cannabis, but I don't know if it's like actually any part of their platform. Is it?
To this day, we don't have a resolution in the organization that defines our position on cannabis. I would say, you know, this is as a member, not this is not a statement from IVAW. I'm just speaking as a member. But I would say that there's a significant amount of members that support cannabis, that use cannabis, and they want to, you know, especially those that live outside Colorado, they want to see safe access to cannabis because this is something that they found that helps them. It doesn't have the effects that, you know, maybe there are pills that the VA is giving veterans out there that might show success, but they also find that a lot of these pills have a lot of adverse effects on top of the effects that might be helping them. So why do you, you know, have to take one, you know, you end up taking multiple pills because you're, yeah, you might have a, you know, an adverse effect that you have to combat with another pill. Whereas cannabis, you know, it might be not 100% effective for all of your ills, but it certainly is not going to add to the problem. And that's certainly,
exactly.
That's like very important when we look at this. And it's very important that we change the scheduling of this, this plant. I mean, it's ridiculous. And we know why, you know, we could sit here and talk about, you know, the demonization of a plant, but we know what the driver is. You know, the demonization goes back to money, and it goes back to the limiting of, you know, trying to prop up certain industries and trying to push down other industries. I mean, we know that hemp and cannabis was used widely before, you know, it was demonized back in, what, the 20s, 30s, or 40s, thereabouts. It was widely used, and now we you know, it's like we stepped so far backward, now we have to come all the way forward to, you know, realize that we left this plant that had so much potential to progress our country, to progress the world, and not only to progress us, but to actually provide opportunity for employment. I mean, there's so much the hemp and cannabis
industry
that provide.
Taken off like crazy, and there are so many opportunities here. And once other states get legalized, there's going to be even more opportunities there. Veterans need to get in on this trend while they can. But we're coming up now. We got 3 minutes left. I just want to give you the opportunity to promote anything that you or IVAW is doing in the near future. Just go ahead and put it out there. We want to promote your activities.
That's great. Rock Veterans Against the War currently is working on two campaigns. One is called Drop the Mic or Drop the Military Industrial Complex. If you want to find out more information, just go to IVAW.org. Along with that campaign, there's also Save the VA campaign. The whole understanding of the Save the VA campaign is based around this recognition that if the VA is left to certain people's hands, it might become privatized. And I think that would be, you know, we know that the VA has many, 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 many problems, but we feel that, you know, these problems could be looked at and fixed if the right people are in place. But if the VA is turned and privatized, I think we recognize that that causes more problems, and I think it takes away from services because there's more of a profit-driven incentive there opposed to the incentive of actually taking care of veterans. So those are two campaigns that we're supporting, or we're just in the midst of developing, and we put out the Drop the Mic campaigns first. And for more information, like I said, go to IVAW.org. For me specifically, in the month of November, we will have locally in Colorado Springs in the Pikes Peak region, we'll be showing the Celebrating People's History Year Project, which is a collaboration of 10 years of artwork from the anti-war community, not only veterans but allies of the anti-war community have this artwork. It's 80 different pieces. We're going to have many different pieces throughout the region, Hopefully in the Pikes Peak Library District, you'll be seeing some of these pieces of art. Pikes Peak Community College is in. We might have some space on the campus of the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Colorado College might be on board. And also,
well, that's the end music. We'll put out more information on your projects here on the website. And I just want to thank you, Matt, for coming in to the show. Thanks for tuning in to MGBN and 1620 Talk. This is Matthew Kale, your local cannabis evangelist. Thank you and good night.
Thanks for having me. Peace.